Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In this hour, details of a working legacy of the late Kentucky poet, novelist, short story writer, and photographer James Baker Hall. Lexington poet Dorian Hairston takes us into the pages of his new book, Pretend the Ball is Named Jim Crow. We have the story of the Decode Project, created to support and promote literacy among young Kentuckians, and an evening of civility witnessed in Whitesburg, Kentucky. But first, April marks the 75th anniversary of the creation of NATO and its guarantee that its members, the U.S. and its European and Asian allies, will have each other's back in the face of a military threat, including nuclear. It's a year that has seen Oppenheimer, the story of the birth of atomic warfare, sweep the Academy Awards.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
What do you want from theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
It's a year of wars in Ukraine and Gaza that are testing the resolve of the West. And it's a year of an American presidential election that many view as the most consequential of a lifetime. What's the connection here? Whomever is elected in November will have sole authority to launch those nuclear weapons. We thought you'd want to be aware of this as you consider those ballot options. Bill Hennigan writes about national security, foreign policy, and conflict for the opinion section at the New York Times. He also is the lead writer of the Times' chilling series, At the Brink, about the modern nuclear threat. And he's with us now. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Bill.
My pleasure.
So, as you have in your commentary in the New York Times, if you would describe for us the full extent of a sitting president's authority to order the launch of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it's a concept that I don't think a lot of Americans are familiar with, which is, you know, in America, we have a nuclear monarchy. The nuclear arsenal is the president's alone to decide when and how to use those weapons. And that power is absolute. He or she is not required by any law or mandate to consult with any of his or her advisors, the courts, or Congress. And it's unlike any other aspect of the U.S. military, which, as you know, of course, has a very strict chain of command.
Well, how long has the American president had this sole authority?
Since the very beginning of the bomb. In 1945, you know, President Harry Truman, when he made the decision to use the weapons in Japan and Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the days after and the months after, there was this sort of debate about how and when to use nuclear weapons. Should they just be used as another facet of the arsenal, or are they special? And President Truman came to the conclusion that these weapons were too important to be delegated down to lower military officers for use. And of course, during the Cold War, you know, you didn't want to have some sort of brazen action, you know, after Russia developed the bomb, to have some sort of accident or some overreaching officer end up causing a nuclear World War III.
Well, I guess senior advisors in the White House can try to talk a president out of it, but am I correct in understanding that we're left to rely on the mental stability, the competence, and the judgment of those lone individuals to make a decision that really could alter nothing less than the course of human history?
Right. So as I lay out in the essay, there are two instances in which a president can use weapons, right? And the first one is if an adversary launches a nuclear strike toward the United States, how would a U.S. president respond? And it takes 30 minutes from an intercontinental ballistic missile on one side of the Earth to land in the United States. So, you know, if you break that down rationally, you probably have about 50, you know, to detect the thing, to determine whether or not it's real or not, and where it's going to strike. You probably only have 15 minutes to actually make a decision on whether or not to launch a counterstrike. And, you know, 15 minutes is not a lot of time. So I think in that case, you know, of course, you know, you expect the president to sign on with advisors, but you don't want to garble up that decision-making process with other people. And the other instance, which is nuclear first strike, where there is time to come to a more thought-through action, I think that we should just ensconce in law what we expect from any rational president, which would be that he or she would convene with senior advisors and cabinet members. And let's designate three senior advisors, and at least two of those three need to give an up or down vote on the use of weapons. And if two say thumbs up, then I think that makes good sense. But all I'm asking Congress to do is just make a law based on what we'd expect good judgment, a good faith acting president to do.
And just to be clear, right now, we don't have that at all.
No, not at all. I mean, a president could, you know, issue an order, could call up U.S. Strategic Command or in the military and order a nuclear strike. Now, any U.S. military officer can decline an order that they deem to be illegal. But I will make two points on that. Number one is in the U.S. military, the whole military is geared towards following orders, not rejecting them. And the second thing I will say is that the former commander in charge of U.S. nuclear forces was asked about this very thing in 2017. And he said, okay, well, there are checks and balances. If this was not talked about before, if there's no planning, the president's order would be flagged and that would be debated. And then the congressman pushed him and said, well, you know, what would you do? And the senior military commander got uncomfortable, noticeably uncomfortable in his seat, and said, well, you know, started chuckling, saying, you know, well, thankfully, these are all hypotheticals. You know, I was never faced with this. That sort of thing is not good enough. You know, the Pentagon plans for all sorts of contingencies, and this should certainly be one of them.
Has it ever happened before? Has it ever gotten to that stage before?
Well, what we do know is that during President Nixon's administration in the 70s, you know, at the tail end of his administration, he was often drunk and depressed because of the tremendous stress that was on him during those waning days, and that he did ask Strategic Command to provide him with potential target in North Korea. Thankfully, Henry Kissinger, a senior advisor at the time, you know, stepped in and was able to call that off after that drunken call. In the Trump administration as well, there was fears, particularly right after January 6th, that President Trump might try to wield nuclear weapons to put the country in further chaos. And this is all in a book by Bob Woodward Peril. And General Milley stepped in and said to Speaker Pelosi that if anything happens like that, I'll step in. Well, the truth is that there's no legal basis by which he can do something like that. So while it's never occurred before, there have been these sorts of close calls and reason for concern.
Well, what sort of procedure goes into motion when this happens, when it's confirmed that nuclear missiles are incoming?
There is always a designated official that's with a president, you know, in case a crisis or emergency occurs. You know, most famously, you'll remember on 9/11 when President Bush was with a room full of school children reading a book. And you remember the official walked over and whispered in his ear that America was under attack. And then, you know, there's also a U.S. military officer that always shadows the president. And if you look for this, you'll see it. There's an officer and he or she is carrying a leather satchel, like a briefcase, which is called the nuclear football, contains nuclear plans in case the president ever has to order a nuclear attack on the fly. So in such a case, the official would tell the president would walk over to the military officer and consult the nuclear football and the menu of options. And it's like, you know, going to Denny's, right? There's a menu of different options that the president can take. And he would be connected immediately with the U.S. Strategic Command commander, which oversees all nuclear forces, as well as other senior advisors in his cabinet and, you know, kind of work through the options on what to do. If an order is made, that goes to the military and is dispersed through the chain of command down to the forces. So, you know, nuclear forces are intercontinental ballistic missiles that are in the Great Plains, our bomber forces, and submarines under the sea. And that order would be distributed out. And again, the time that it would take for a president to make a decision like that and be disseminated out so that we can counterattack is roughly around 10 to 15 minutes.
Wow. Well, in that chain of command, down to the bomber squadrons, the subs, the missile silos, are humans with loved ones. Can you ever fully prepare for the moment when you get that order to push a button?
I mean, boy, it's hard to imagine being in a position like that, of course. But I've covered the national security for 15 years, and you know, I can tell you that you know that's what they drill. That's part of their job, is to ensure that if the unthinkable ever occurs, that they're ready to respond. They're aware of the responsibility that they have, and it's a reality they have to confront every day.
What about the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, MAD, it's called, the strategy that's based on the idea that a full-scale nuclear attack and counterattack would cause the complete annihilation of both attacker and defender? Is that stalemate pretty much the thing that's holding the world back from nuclear war, do you think?
Yes, I think that fear, you know, which essentially MAD is, and deterrence, as it's called within the nuclear world, that is essential to the stability when it comes to nuclear forces, that if you do go nuclear, the thing that you're trying to gain will be outstripped by what will come your way in return, so that you will end up being a loser if you decide to take that step. And indeed, this is held, you know, remarkably for 79 years, this taboo.
Last October, Russia's Duma, their parliament, if you will, voted to withdraw Moscow's ratification of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, and that's as the U.S. Senate continued to refuse to even debate ratification. Are any commitments in place, any international nuclear weapons treaties?
For just testing or treaties just generally?
Boy, I guess both.
So when it comes to testing, the United States has committed to hold the ban on testing, you know, which it hasn't done since the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. You are starting to see nations talk a little bit more about the willingness to test. Thankfully, the only nation that's been testing nuclear weapons is North Korea in modern years. When it comes to the sort of infrastructure of arms control treaties that we have enjoyed, you know, for the last quarter century, all of those are slowly unwinding. You know, President Reagan administration, you know, at the tail end of his administration, he set the United States and the Soviet Union on a path for continual reductions. You know, nuclear weapons at a peak, and then slowly we've whittled down our nuclear forces, and it's still around 4,000 weapons, which is a heck of a lot of weapons, but it's far less than the peak, which was around 70,000 at the height of the Cold War.
Well, we have Vladimir Putin's threats to use nuclear weapons in the war in Ukraine. Iran seems to be continuing to enrich uranium, getting closer to weapons grade. North Korea, as you mentioned, building nuclear weapons and long-range missiles, testing them. Nuclear expansion in Pakistan and India. The potential of the war in Gaza between Israel and Hamas to escalate. Is this a time, Bill, to have a lot of concern about global nuclear stability?
Precisely. And that's why we decided, the New York Times decided to pursue this project at this time, is because you do have this volatile world where all of the nuclear nations are either building up or enhancing their nuclear forces, you know, and this is coming at a time, as we discussed, of all of the sort of safeguards, the guardrails, the various treaties have either sunsetted or have been completely abandoned. We only have one remaining treaty, and that expires in less than 2 years. So there will be no cap on the number of strategic weapons that nations can have. And, you know, with this sort of open competition, you know, that stokes fears of arms race and a possible opening up of testing and these sorts of things. And all of those potential conflicts that you mentioned all have nuclear components to them. And so we're kind of threading a needle here, and it's very perilous, and it's cause for concern. We should demand that our politicians pay more attention to what's going on in the world, because there hasn't been a heck of a lot of conversation about this sort of thing. And I think, you know, we as in the citizenry should demand that our politicians pay more attention.
It is overwhelmingly troubling to think about. And maybe that's why we're all kind of in a state of denial about it. But given the circumstances that we just talked about, we have to think about this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, because it's, you know, you almost have to put it in the realm of abstraction. But, you know, I often liken it to global warming and climate change, where there is an activism involved in that. And there are changes in law that have tried to put us on a better track when it comes to these sorts of things. So when you have these stakes so high, of course, I understand that it's hard to really grasp, and everybody has enough problems in their lives that they don't want to worry about coming Armageddon. But I think that it's a relatively simple ask that our, you know, we ask that our politicians ensure the fact that we don't end up spiraling in a situation that we don't want to end up in.
All right, that's Bill Hennigan. He writes about national security, foreign policy, and conflict for the opinion section at the New York Times. He is the lead writer for the Times series At the Brink, about the modern nuclear threat, and the commentary we've been talking about here, titled Sole Authority. And I recommend you Google and dig into those articles. Bill Hennigan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Back with much more in a moment. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Winchester's Lead Center for the Arts will present a stage adaptation of Alexander Dumas's The Three Musketeers, May 3rd through 5th and 10th through 12th. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit leadscenter.org. The Appalachian Artisan Center in Hindman holds its free art and action classes 5 to 6:30 p.m. every Thursday at the center. The program is for children ages 6 and up and includes kids' crafts, fine art, and an open clay studio. For more information, visit artisancenter.net/workshops. And join the Kentucky Arts Council in celebration of Kentucky Writers' Day, April 24th at the Thomas D. Clark Center for Kentucky History in Frankfort. For more information, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
More than half of Kentucky students are below grade level in reading skills. It's a troubling statistic that can have serious consequences for success in school and work and life, for that matter. It's the focus for education contributor Gil Hunter's latest guest.
Latoya Whitlock is co-founder and executive director of Louisville's Decode Project, an educational support organization founded in 2018 to provide equitable and empowering access to literacy. The Decode Project emphasizes a structured literacy approach, seeing students' ability to read as essential to confidence and success in school. Ms. Whitlock, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me today.
Absolutely. So lots of media reports say, every few months, that our kids can't read. What does it mean that our kids can't read? Which kids? And how do we know that they struggle to read?
That's a really simple question that has a really complex answer. And even if you go to the research, the data, it's not very clear how you can make sense of it. But locally in Kentucky, we know that at least only a third of our kids are reading at grade level proficiency, according to the National Assessment of Education Progress. And that isn't new information. That's something that we've consistently been relatively on a decline since around the late 90s. Which kids? All kids essentially are struggling to read or struggling readers, but we know that, like most of our education failures, it disproportionately falls on the backs of Black and Brown students and those who qualify for free or reduced lunch.
So you're the executive director of the Decode Project, as we said. I'm betting decoding then is one of the reading skills you all focus on there. Can you tell me what the Decode Project is and what you do?
We are about 5.5-year-old nonprofit. We were created to address the literacy crisis that we saw over 5.5 years ago. We came to this work as a school counselor. I worked at a private school. We were able to handpick the students that came to our school, yet we still struggled. More than 65% of our kids also weren't reading at grade level proficiency. And so that's how Decode Project was born. We are providing students with structured literacy, or some say the science of reading. And that's a one-to-one and small group literacy support. And it's tailored to meet the individual needs of each student. We hire and train college-age students primarily. Many of them are future educators. They're trained, given the research of the science of reading, provided with some curriculums that are under the umbrella of the science of reading. And they work with the same student over the course of a year or so.
All right. So you mentioned structured literacy and the science of reading. I'd like you to talk a little more about that. Why is that the approach to literacy you take at Decode Project? And then, I guess, how do you know it's working for students you work with?
I know that we are in a very polarized political climate, even around reading. And so there's a whole language approach that has been used probably since the late 80s. And then there is this body of research that is a science of reading that incorporates linguistics, research around education, research around neuroscience, research around the different ways that the brain is able to retain information. The science of reading uses this approach because we believe it's the best version of teaching kids, to teach anyone actually, to read well. Our brains, which I thought this was fascinating, our brains are not necessarily hardwired for reading. And I know there's a lot of information that would suggest that exposing kids to books early, or reading for 20 minutes to your child from birth or even before, while it does help influence a child's opinion of reading or their interest in reading, and some kids may even pick up some skills around reading, it doesn't necessarily mean that that child will become a proficient reader. The science of reading is very explicit. It builds on itself. I like to compare it to a piano. You can watch someone play a piano. You might even be interested in the music that comes from a piano, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can become a prodigy at playing a piano unless you read the notes and understand the chords. And that's essentially what the science of reading and structured literacy does for students.
Okay, so that makes great sense. So maybe it's an easy question to answer, but how do you know it's working for the students that you all work with at the Decode Project?
Well, it works in a couple of ways. I, again, come from a school counselor background. So I understand that for us, the easiest thing we can do is use the science of reading, and we know we're going to bake the cake. You need flour, you need butter, you need sugar, you need decoding skills, you need students to be able to segment, you need fluency, you need exposure to different materials and vocabulary. We know that we're able to teach kids to read. The hardest part of our job is helping kids gain the confidence and being able to read, and that happens in that one-to-one or small group setting with the same mentor over time. So one of the ways that we know that our program is working is because kids go from having their head down to being super excited about learning to read, being willing to be at school all day long doing a hard thing, and then after school, come and do a hard thing again and be a willing participant in order to do that. And then, of course, just the brass tacks. We see the gains in their decoding skills. We see the gains in their phonemic awareness. We see the gains in their fluency. And one of the schools that we work with, a teacher just mentioned to us that every student who was plucked from her class that has been in our program over the course of the year has gained 18 to 25 points in their MAP scores, which is the proof in the pudding.
Right, right. And I appreciate one thing you said there about working with the schools. I wondered about that a little bit. How does Decode Project work with public schools there in Louisville? How do you work with teachers? Obviously, you work with students, but then also, do you work with parents? And what does that look like?
We are partnered with JCPS, our local school district. We're under contract to work at a couple of schools this year. And essentially what that means is we provide tier two instruction. So after the teacher teaches the entire class, those students who need additional supports have one-to-one or small group instruction from our literacy mentors. We also have a before school program, since some of the school times have changed. So kids are getting that early, first thing in the morning, introduction to literacy in the morning, in partnership with the Louisville Leopards and JCPS. And then we work with caregivers and teachers be our caregiver orientation. So every caregiver that enrolls a child in our program, and even caregivers who are just interested, they learn more about the science of reading, our particular approach. They get to hear from some of the caregivers who've already been in our program to support them and rally around them. There's nothing more intimidating than caregivers going to ARC meetings or hearing that my child can't read and learning they're supposed to be on a level J, but they're on a level B, and not understanding what any of that means and how to navigate or support their student at home. And that's where our caregiver resources and workshops really support them navigating that system.
What's the goal of the DECODE project? I noticed on the DECODE project website that 45 million adults in the U.S. are what we consider functionally illiterate. So maybe that's one way of asking that question. What will a literate society look like when you all are successful with what you've got going on?
In a dream world, and it doesn't necessarily just have to be a dream, we can make this a reality, we would have a safer society. What we know is that more than 70% of those who experience mass incarceration and recidivism are functionally illiterate, and that's just the adults. We know that juveniles in the state of Kentucky, more than 65 to 70% of those young people are functionally illiterate. If you provide kids, young people, adults with a tool that opens up the entire world to them, the possibilities are endless. We'd have a safer society. We'd have more folks who are gainfully employed, could potentially have more home ownership. And then folks just have the ability to dream the impossible dream, to work out whatever creative aspirations they may have. What we know is one in five individuals has a language-based learning difference. And so instead of those kids being relegated to special needs classes or just not being seen at all if they're quiet, every kid would have the opportunity in a classroom to learn to read with explicit instruction. And then finally, my board of directors doesn't love when I say this, but I mean it with my whole heart. We would go out of business and find something else to do. DECODE Project would work with the smallest population of folks who really struggle with learning to read. And that is really a small population if given early and consistent intervention. The research says that 96% of all people have the ability to learn to read when given the science of reading.
Thank you for your time today. I've been talking with LaToya Whitlock, Executive Director of the DECODE Project in Louisville. Ms. Whitlock, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having us.
This is Gil Hunter for Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Gil Hunter is Assistant Vice President for Retention and Graduation here at EKU. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Josh Gibson may not be a household name, but many believe it should be, because Josh Gibson is considered by baseball historians to be one of the best power hitters and the best catcher ever. In 1972, he became the second Negro League player to be inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. But there also was a lot of pain in Josh Gibson's life, and it's all captured in the pages of a new book of poetry, Pretend the Ball is Named Jim Crow. It's by poet, scholar, and former University of Kentucky baseball player Dorian Hairston. Dorian's a member of the Afro-Latchian Poets, and his work has appeared in Shale, Anthology of Appalachian Writers, and Pluck. And he's here with us. Dorian, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dorian, tell us how you were drawn to the story of Josh Gibson, and tell us a little bit about him as well.
I was drawn to the story of Josh Gibson as a high school senior. Frank X. Walker was the poet laureate of the state of Kentucky at that time. And my high school creative writing teacher had invited him to come read from his Isaac Murphy, I Dedicate This Ride. While he was on campus, he heard me read some poetry about this baseball player. And backtrack, she was like, okay, you need to write a book for your independent study like Frank X. Walker, because he's going to be here later this year, and I want him to hear you read. So I go to the library. I start writing these poems about Jackie Robinson and Happy Chandler and Branch Rickey. And she was like, these are not the best. So she sent me back to the library to find somebody who was less known, who had a little bit more interesting story. And we ended up with Josh Gibson. So Josh Gibson, born 1911, passes away 1947 of a brain tumor. His wife passes away giving birth to a set of twins She's 18 years old. He's 19 years old at the time. And he hit over 800 home runs in his career. And I, as a Black baseball player, just, you know, 1 year at this point, younger than Josh, when he loses his wife, I'm trying to figure out what it means to be a Black baseball player. I was a power hitter. So I obviously admired him for those reasons. I was like, okay, I've got to figure out more about this guy's story. So then that's where we returned to Frank X. Walker on campus at Tate's Creek High School. And he hears me read. I go to the University of Kentucky and I study under Frank. And as I'm studying under him, these voices start to materialize. I start to figure out who in the story needs to tell what parts of said story. And that's how we ended up with this collection.
Well, although the title speaks volumes, tell us about its meaning.
This is where I'm going to give another shout out to Frank. Frank was teaching us form, and he was really interested in having us create these forms if we could. So I've created what I've called a world series. It's 9 couplets inside of a poem. And I was really into manifestos at that time. I was taking a class where we were reading a lot of manifestos. So I wrote a manifesto for Black baseball players from the persona of Josh Gibson. It's what I think Josh would tell me as a Black baseball player. And I wanted it to be really short, mirror a baseball game. I didn't know at that time when I started writing it that I wanted the last line to have absolutely nothing to do with baseball and have everything to do with living a full life. But in that poem, I was like, okay, Josh has to say something about being a power hitter. And how do you channel that much energy into one swing? Where does that power come from? And I just thought, you know, if there's one thing that Black folk hate more than anything in the world, it is oppression. How do I place that in this poem? It is, we're going to pretend the ball is named Jim Crow. We're going to hit this ball so far that people can't find it.
Ah, well, the poetry in these pages is really a vivid account of the Black American experience, I would say. Do you see baseball's history in general as a metaphor for the truth of life in America?
Absolutely. I think about, like, the integration of baseball, for example. So Jackie Robinson breaks the color barrier in 1947. You know, shortly thereafter, you've got several players that start entering the major leagues and proving that not only are they good, several of them are the best. And the white players knew that at the time too. And that's the thing that I think that mirrors the United States the most, is that throughout our history as a country, we have been fully aware as a society that the way in which we're treating our brothers and our sisters, our countrymen and women, the people that we share the space with, poorly, and for really bad reasons. So fast forward a few years, you get Brown v. Board of Education that overturns Plessy v. Ferguson, eliminating separate but equal as the law of the land, or the practice of the land, or both. And I do not think that you can separate the integration of baseball from the integration of schools to then the continuation of the Black freedom struggle, or what some folks might want to call the civil rights movement, to temporalize it. But I do not think we can separate any of those things. So I think that baseball is not only a metaphor, it is America.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, did you make any discoveries as you worked on the book? Any aha moments as you worked on it?
So actually, I love that question. The big thing for me that kind of shocked me the most is that I kind of knew, again, I'm a high schooler when I start this project, I kind of knew that the Negro Leagues existed, but I never really fully understood why. And I just assumed that Black folks hated that the Negro Leagues existed and that they did not enjoy playing, and they were just waiting for that opportunity to break into the major leagues. What I found was that the Negro Leagues was a great experience. Like, it was like these players loved playing and the fans loved it even more. The Negro Leagues didn't discriminate in the same way that major league ball clubs did. There were white Negro League baseball players. If you could play and you were at the field and you were on the team. And I expected, when I started this research, for that to not be the case. I expected it to be kind of like a and a blacks only exclusive club. And that was not the case. White folks, and I talk about this in the book, but white folks attended the games too, and they loved it. White Major League Baseball players would barnstorm against these teams and get embarrassed. And they loved their competitors, so they loved the competition. I wasn't expecting that. It felt like every turn of my research, I was finding something. I was like, this is not what I would have intuitively thought about the Negro Leagues.
So interesting. And if I may, Dorian, I'd like to ask you to pick out a favorite among these poems and maybe give us a reading.
Ooh. Mm. Well, since we just talked about it, I'll read the first poem in the collection where the title of the collection comes from. And as I'm reading it, it's written in innings, so I will actually say the name of the innings. There's a few poems in here that are written in this form. So, Manifesto for Black Baseball Players, persona Josh Gibson. 1. Never forget the 42 reasons baseball is best played with color. 2. Steal bases like they stole this country. 3. Break into record books, turn more than just they ink black. 4. Pretend the ball is named Jim Crow. 5. Decolonize the Hall of Fame. 6. Remember we gave the game lights, helmets, and style. 7. Never be controlled by anything white. 8. Belt, lift every voice and sing during they national anthem. 9. Find you a Helen, drop down on one knee, place a baseball field on her fourth finger.
Mm. What do you hope the reader takes away from reading Pretend the Ball is Named Jim Crow?
I hope they take away a lot. What I really love the most is for folks when they finish reading to have a new perspective of the beauty of the game, to acknowledge all of the different cultures that have contributed to the game and contributed to the history of this country. And most of all, I want them to understand that this is a story about love, love for one's significant other, love for children, love for joy, love for, you know, other human beings that you get to share space with and be entertained with or entertain with. There is a lot of pain in here. But to read this as just a story about pain is to, I think, completely misread everything. And I wrote it. So I hope that I came across clearly to my reader in that.
Oh, you sure do. And you close the book with a wish. If you would tell us about that.
I close it with several wishes. If you're talking specifically about the wish that Major League Baseball changes the name of the MVP award to the Josh Gibson Award. I think about how important it is for us to rightly acknowledge the best. And I think that this is a perfect opportunity as Major League Baseball is making strides. And I appreciate these strides in righting some of these wrongs throughout its history. I am hopeful that we can get to where we acknowledge these men were, I think, the greatest to ever play the game, and they were not allowed to play Major League Baseball. So they are removed. They do not exist inside of our record books, or if they do, we squabble about which records actually count, which games count, et cetera, et cetera. I would love for Major League Baseball to just say, you know what, we're just going to make this right now. MVP Awards, Josh Gibson Award. That's simple.
All right, that's Dorian Hairston, Lexington poet and author of Pretend the Ball is Named Jim Crow. It's published by the University Press of Kentucky. It's now available online at kentuckypress.com. You can find it on Amazon and the other online booksellers. Dorian, thank you so much. Great book.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Writers, photographers, listen up. Tom Eblen's guest for the latest in his Kentucky Author Series has a date you'll want to mark in your calendar.
The late James Baker Hall was a versatile talent, a poet, novelist, short story writer, and photographer. He also was a great teacher who spent more than 30 years on the English faculty at the University of Kentucky, where he also served as director of the Creative Writing Program. He was inducted into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame in 2014. James Baker Hall's son, Larry Pimble, recently created a nonprofit foundation to memorialize his father's work, and more importantly, to provide support and encouragement for future generations of Kentucky writers and photographers. The foundation will have a launch event May 1st from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. Larry Pimble is with us today to talk about the James Baker Hall Foundation. Larry, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Tom, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, first, tell us a little more about your father, James Baker Hall.
Well, he was an artist from the time he got up in the morning until he went to sleep at night, and all day, every day, and that's what he did, and that was what he loved to do, and it was his calling from the time he was, a freshman in college is when the button was pushed and he discovered T.S. Eliot, and there was nothing turned him away from that ever again. And that was the energy and the brilliance of him as an educator was that he had that kind of drive. And it was really an amazing outpouring of art over his whole life.
Wow. Well, what inspired you to create this foundation?
He passed away in 2009, and Marianne Taylor Hall, his wife, my stepmother, edited his memoir. And that took a couple of years. And then we were looking to get that published, and that was her promise to him on his deathbed kind of thing. And then COVID came and we got delayed for a little while. And I made sure that that book got published so that Marianne could see that it was done. What amazed me was so many people were overjoyed to see that book and to talk about my dad. And I hadn't never seen that kind of energy, 10, 12 years later. And I just thought that that was something that shouldn't be wasted. And he's part of a group. It's our work at the foundation is not so much about him anymore. It's really about the legacy of great artists in Kentucky, because that's really what we're looking to capitalize on.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, tell us a little more about what you hope to accomplish with the foundation.
His wish was that we help aspiring artists to be artists. And he was a working artist his whole life. And so we have a couple of programs that we think will facilitate getting writers and photographers in Kentucky able to produce their work and show their work and talk about it and sell it. And that's what he would have liked for us to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any specific plans laid out? I know you've been looking at several options of ways to do that.
We have a couple of things that'll kick off this year. We'll have an outreach program in Eastern Kentucky and one also over by Louisville in Bullitt County, where we will work with people who are currently having success reaching into underserved populations, finding people who like to write, who benefit from writing poetry or fiction or autobiographical things, whatever it is, and seeing that those people have the opportunity to write and be in the company of other artists. That's where art is made. And so we want to form places for artists to gather. We want to form things that bring them together so they can gather, open mic nights, poetry readings, those kinds of things, and see how far we can take that. We also, on the other side, will do some book awards kind of things to reward people who produce great art.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you have planned for this May 1st event? Tell us a little more about that.
Well, we have a number of really awesome readers, invitations out on our website and things, and some really well-known names and some names that you might not expect to hear in Lexington. And a special aspect to the program will be that there are students that will read at this gathering. If you're a professor and you're reading at the event, you're asked to bring a student and let them read as well, which I think is an opportunity for young aspiring writers to be in the company of what will, I imagine, be royalty in their eyes. I think that there'll be a lot of people there on May 1st.
Mm-hmm. Well, who are some of the readers, names that people might know?
Well, Frank X. Walker is on the slate, and Cecilia Woolash from Bullitt County. I'm not sure people in Lexington will know her, but she's really an amazing poet, and others as well.
You mentioned the memoir. Tell us a little about that. What was the title of that book?
The Missing Body of the Fox. And my father had a huge trauma in his life as when he was 8 years old. His mother, my grandmother, committed suicide in his bed, and he was there when that happened. And that kind of wiped his memory clean as a young child that traumatic event. And he spent the next, 45, 50 years trying to recapture those memories of that time. His family was a traditional Southern patriarchal kind of family, and so they didn't talk about it. They just never talked ever about it. And that's the exploration that he took through working with his family album, making pictures of those people of that time, and gradually came to understand what had happened and that it wasn't his fault, and his mother loved him. And that was a very important mission for him that, that drove him his whole life.
You mentioned his photography. I know there's been, you've put quite a lot of effort into cataloging his archive. He had a huge archive of photographic work, all of which was done by film, of course, back then. How are you trying to make that available?
The archive itself is in the process of defining the body of work. He wasn't much on administration and things, so we've had to go back and catalog everything, and we're in the middle of doing that. And I think that his pictures are really extraordinary in many aspects. And so my goal is just to get it out so people can see and get it a broader exposure. I think we might try to take it out of Kentucky at some point. But right now, we just want Kentucky people to see and celebrate what's been done already. It's a really an amazing body of work.
And a lot of these were portraits of people. I think that some of his best work was I remember recently seeing a portrait of Robert Hazel, the writer and UK professor who was an influence on him. Do you have any long-term plans for where this archive might end up?
The interesting thing about my dad's photography is that he produced 5 or 6 series of images during his life. And to look at them, you wouldn't necessarily be able to tell that they were made by the same man. I mean, it's really that disparate. So I think we'll probably take those series and treat them separately. And the portraits are one. Nature things, of course, he's very well known for that. And of the portraits, of course, Wendell Berry was one of his favorite subjects. And so there's lots of pictures of Wendell. But the lesser known portraits, I think, deserve a separate look. And then in his later work, he digitized a lot of things. He never shot a digital camera. It was always film. But he would take those and he would digitize those images and then experiment with them and did a lot of really. So he would go back to pictures that he took in the 70s and 80s and then use those negatives again. And many generations later, we have what we're looking at today. And then he got addicted to color, of course. So he added a lot of components to those images that he took originally many years earlier.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned your website. That's the JamesBakerHallFoundation.org. So that's a place and people can sign up for information and for new updates on that. And once again, the event on May 1st will be at the Carnegie Center from 5 to 7 p.m. And that's free and open to the public. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, my guest has been Larry Primble from the James Baker Hall Foundation. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Tom, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
For the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, this is Tom Eblin reporting for Eastern Standard.
Eastern Standard contributor Chris Begley is back with some observations he made recently while at a public hearing in Eastern Kentucky around a contentious subject that in these times might easily be expected to turn pretty ugly. Instead, he came away with a lesson for us all.
I went to a public meeting a couple of weeks ago in Whitesburg in Letcher County about the proposed prison. It's a contentious issue, and in a packed high school cafeteria, 40 people stood up and gave their opinions. About half were for it, about half against. For 2 hours, a couple of hundred people sat there and listened to each other. That, in itself, is astonishing. But what was even more remarkable was the way the community interacted. People were civil to each other, even as they vehemently disagreed. Over and over, the speakers made the point that even those with whom they disagreed had the best interest of the community at heart. There wasn't a whole lot of vilification of the other side. Before and after the meeting, I saw people on both sides talking and walking out together. Of course, that's not so surprising, I suppose, because for the most part, they knew each other. They were neighbors and family. At first, I noticed the civility. But as I reflected on it, that's not what really mattered. In fact, sometimes a veneer of civility can be worse than outright conflict. Our history is full of people being civil to each other on the surface while something more nefarious happened behind that facade. A veneer can obscure motives or make something rotten seem sound. So it wasn't only the civility, the politeness, that I noticed. It was how they talked about each other and the motivations they attributed to those on the other side of the issue. There was some degree of generosity. We always have a choice of how we interpret what somebody says or does, and we can give them the benefit of the doubt or not. In this instance, by and large, people seem to do that. Well, who cares that people weren't particularly rude to each other at a small town meeting? Why is that worth talking about? Well, it's not about being rude or polite. It's about seeing each other as people, not caricatures, as three-dimensional, complex. It's one thing to think your neighbor is wrong, and another to think they're fundamentally flawed or an existential threat to your way of life. A caricature is not fully human, not really a person, dehumanized. Think of what we allow ourselves to do to non-humans, to animals. We keep them in cages, we exploit them, even kill them. When we dehumanize somebody, we open up a whole range of bad behavior. That might sound dramatic, I know, but we know our history, and we know what happens when we lose sight of the humanity in our neighbors, when we oversimplify, caricature, or scapegoat. This doesn't mean compromise or to always meet halfway, and it doesn't mean folks always have good intentions. Sometimes one side is right and the other is wrong. Folks in Letcher County didn't come to that meeting to acquiesce or to compromise in order to keep the peace. They argued hard for their position, but never reduced their adversaries to anything less than the people they are. It's a shame that that's noteworthy.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Thanks to Bruce Coburn for the song Us All. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. And if you'd like to call something to our attention or suggest a topic, our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.